From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headlee. The internet has rocked our world and our economy.
Behold the internet!
My God, it's full of ads.
But a recent survey finds 1 in 6 Georgians still do not have access to high-speed internet. Ahead this hour, we spot the broadband deserts. But first, last week, The Break Room talked about sexism.
There's a kind of a continuum of sexism, okay? Like, if it's used to kind of fuel a sitcom, that's one thing. If it's used to downgrade and diminish the contributions of women, that matters. And when you look around and you don't see enough women in Congress, on corporate boards, leading institutions, that's a problem. That makes America weaker.
That's Break Room regular Natalie Pavelski. Here are your first thoughts. Nick Baum writes to us, and hang on for this one. You should do 2 shows on online dating, one from the male's perspective, one from the female's, and yes, plenty for 2 shows there. I have never had a lower opinion of women than I do right now. I attribute it all to online dating. Far as I can tell, there's one woman out there with 1,000 different photographs, and she is rude, full of herself, can't spell, and is nothing like her friend's description of her. All right. And good luck to you, Nick. We always want to hear your 2 cents, your rants as well. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the program. A recent lawsuit raises questions about students' privacy rights on high school campuses. The suit argues hundreds of students at Worth County High School in Sylvester, Georgia, were subjected to a humiliating pat-down by local sheriff's deputies. Attorney Crystal Redd of the Southern Center for Human Rights filed suit against the Worth County Sheriff's Office. She says on April 14th, students at the school were put on lockdown without a reason given.
Nearly 900 students were then ordered out of their classrooms into the hallways, and then each student was physically searched. The hands of the law enforcement officers were touching the students' bodies in order to conduct this search under the guise of searching, doing a drug sweep.
Even though hundreds of students were searched, Red says the investigation focused on a small number of them.
Sheriff Hobby came with what was a target list of 13 students that they believed to be involved in some type of illegal drug activity, but only 3 of those students on that list were actually present in the school. And those students were taken to administrators' offices and searched and remained in those administrator offices for the entirety of the search.
We reached out to Worth County Sheriff Jeff Hobby. He did not respond. In April, he told WALB-TV that as long as a school administrator was present, the personal search of the children was legal. His office told the New York Times to refer all questions to a lawyer, who also didn't respond to our request for comment. Robin McDougall is with us. She is the director of the Office of Public Policy Outreach at L. Douglas Wilder School of Government and Public Affairs. That's at Virginia Commonwealth University. Robin, good morning to you.
Good morning, Tony. How are you
doing? I'm great. Talk me off my ledge here. help me. So imagine this. Let's paint this picture for everyone. So we're talking about 900 or so students pulled from their classes, lined up in hallways, and searched by sheriff's deputies, and there are drug-sniffing dogs on scene as well. What was your reaction when you heard this?
Well, you know, Tony, it's a very interesting situation. You know, there have been Supreme Court decisions as, you know, most recently as in the late 80s that have talked about school administrators' roles in being able to search students on school grounds and having some authority around being able to expand the unreasonable search and, you know, right to privacy. But this situation is extremely unique. You're not talking about a school administrator calling in law enforcement and asking for the search because they're concerned. You're not talking about a school administrator conducting the search of a classroom or someone's car or a locker. You're talking about a sheriff's department bringing in their officers on I'm assuming, based on the information provided in the media, a tip that they received
exactly.
that a small group of students were selling drugs or possessing drugs in the school. Now, when you think about that logic, then how could they have come into the school, asked to know where those few students were, perhaps even gone as far as searched the room, had the drug-sniffing dogs walk through the classrooms of where those students were? That might have been more reasonable in this conversation and argument, but searching 900 students, that's where I think we've kind of moved beyond what the court has said in previous decisions around a school system and a school administrator's authority to perhaps exceed some of the rights to privacy and rights to unreasonable searches for students. So I think that this is a very unique situation that brings about a lot of questions around how in the world do you argue that all 900 students were a legitimate opportunity to search?
Help me understand this. Let's try to put on law enforcement's hat, as difficult as it is, and the fit is uncomfortable. But let's try to do that for a moment here. What in your mind would justify receiving a tip of a few students perhaps being involved in drug activity, and that tip leading to a search of the premises? Okay, I get that. But of patting down, of searching 900 students based on a tip that speaks to a few students being involved.
That's the problem, Tony, that piece right there. I can make the very strong argument and support around searching a group of students that could be involved with those five students, a classroom of students even where those five students are. I can't make a strong legal or honestly logical argument on searching all 900 students. Now, if there was something where someone sends a tip that says, you know, some kind of very toxic illegal substance is being sold and there's a risk of students overdosing, and we know that a huge majority of students at this school have this drug on them. But that's not what the presentation was. And I still think that would be a weak argument, by the way. But that's not what the presentation was. So I think that's the struggle that the sheriff's going to have, is the 900 student search. But I do think that this does bring up an interesting question, which is going to, I think, see this case make its way up through the court system. Mm-hmm. Not around what this sheriff did in the search of the 900 students. I think that's going to be thrown out, and we're going to see some
settlement.
civil settlements, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
But what we are saying now is we know the role of school administrators, the court's decision on the role of school administrators searching without probable cause and the student's lack of right to privacy by school administration. But that's not what happened here. Was what happens when law enforcement comes into the school and they act not on the request of the school administration, but on a tip they receive? Are they going to be asked to follow the normal probable cause procedure that we would expect outside of a school, or do they fall under this caveat of school administration? That's what I think this case is going to give us some court rulings moving forward that are going to give some guidance to law enforcement on what their purview is in these school systems.
Well, Robin, I'm not going to let you off the hook. I'm going to give you a moment here to answer your own question here, but I want you to listen to Attorney Crystal Redd of the Southern Center for Human Rights. She says sheriff deputies, and we're getting more insight on, you know, the nature of this search, that the sheriff deputies who carried out this search were intrusive as they searched students at the school.
Deputies inserted their fingers inside of young women's bras, pulled up the young women's bras, touching and partially exposing their bare breasts. They cupped and groped young men's genitals and their buttocks. That's some of the most intrusive searching that went on.
Yeah, and just the sound of that, right? That's not good. Okay, so I guess I want you to answer your own question, but let me maybe set it up with this. The Worth County Sheriff, his name is Jeff Hobby, he said the personal search of the children was legal because a school administrator was present. Is that true?
That the search becomes legal because the school administrator
was
present?
Was just present, not conducting the search, but was present at the time of the search as it was being carried out.
It depends. I mean, I think that the attorney is going to have great grounds here, that there's a difference between what we consider a pat-down search. We call that a Terry pat, that an officer could say, I'm patting down a student to make sure that they don't have any weapons that could hurt me. That is not what was depicted in what the attorney was presenting. The under the bra search, the humiliation of students in a public area to do that search. I mean, even when you're in police custody in a police department, searches are conducted in certain closed areas. Searches are conducted by, in most cases, female officers when there's a female detained person. So I think that the sheriff is going to, he is right in the fact that the court has said searches can be conducted legally by law enforcement in the presence of administration. I think that this is beyond a pat-down search or a search of a locker. I also think that the court said in that 1985 finding or decision that when the administration has requested the search.
Yes, yes.
That's going to be the other key piece.
That was
here.
Not the case here, correct?
No, based on what's been presented both by the attorney and by the media facts, that's not been the case here.
Okay.
So I think that it's not as simple as the administrators were present, thus the search is legal. I think there's a lot of unique factors in this search that makes that a lot more complex.
So, Robin, a couple of pieces here. The interim Worth County Superintendent Lawrence Walters said, I've never been involved with anything like that, talking about the search, ever in the past 21 years, and I don't condone it. My question is, was he in a position to stop it?
So that is an interesting thing. We've been talking a lot about that recently in the criminal justice arena. And, you know, I think he could have tried to stop it. But in all honesty, law enforcement has the authority to come into a building if they believe there is a crime occurring. What the question becomes is private property or not. So do we deem the school private property?
Mm-hmm.
We deem the school the county's property, so we would say that law enforcement could potentially have the right to go in there. I don't know that superintendent had grounds beyond just the moral grounds of saying, I can't let this happen, that he would have stopped it. I mean, that his actions, that he had any legal authority to stop it in that situation, because we're in a situation where we've never seen this before, and he's exactly right. He's not the only person that's never seen anything like this before.
Yeah, and one more bit I want to share with you here. This is from the University of Georgia Law Professor Hillel Levine, who says it's not clear if law enforcement actually has the same rights as school officials to search students.
Has not been entirely clear as to how the difference between police officials versus school officials would change. And lower courts have offered some slightly different approaches. But it is clear, in some respects at least, there would be a higher bar for police officials to pass in order to conduct these kinds of searches.
And Robin, last thoughts from you as to where you see this going in the court system.
I think the law professor, you know, hit it on the nail on the head in that one. I think we're gonna force the court with this case to give much more clear guidance on what the expectations are for law enforcement in these situations, and specifically in situations where they're coming into the school, not on the bequest of the administrators. And he's right. We have not gotten any clear guidance for law enforcement by the courts. But I think this case is going to be the one that's going to push some pretty good guidance for law enforcement on how they will be able to operate and what standards they will be using.
Robin, appreciate it. Robin McDougall, she's the director of the Office of Public Policy Outreach at the L. Douglas Wilder School of Government and Public Affairs. That's at Virginia Commonwealth University. Robin, thank you.
Thank you so much, Tony. Have a great day.
It's on Second Thought. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headlee. This is National HIV Testing Day. The annual campaign urges people to learn their HIV status. This hits close to home in Atlanta. The CDC says we lead most metro areas in new HIV diagnoses. An Emory University analysis finds more than 31,000 people living with the disease in Atlanta. A collection at Emory sheds light on the origins of the HIV/AIDS crisis. It showcases photos taken in the 1980s by Atlanta photographer Billy Howard. Doug Lotus was one of a dozen people who agreed to be photographed for the collection. My colleague Celeste Headley spoke with both of them last year.
So let's start, Doug, by I'm wondering about that experience of being photographed, and you knew that this was for a collection of photos of other people also struggling through HIV or AIDS. So was it difficult for you to make the decision to be part of that?
Well, yes. It did take a little time. Billy came. I was in a support group at, I think it was the Atlanta Gay Center, maybe, at the time. And Billy came to us and made his proposal. And I probably took about a week before I got back in touch with him, because certainly in 1987, 88, the stigma around someone with HIV or AIDS was huge. And you couldn't get insurance. You could be denied a job, housing. The discrimination could be severe. So when I said, Billy, I really want to do this, but I don't want to be totally recognizable.
And that's why you have a turtleneck covering part of your face?
Correct. And my hands.
Billy, how difficult was it for you to convince people to be part of this collection of photos, especially at a time when a diagnosis of HIV or AIDS was, for many people, a death sentence?
Well, I knew that at the time, and the stigma was so intense that, for me, I decided that I didn't want to convince anybody to be a part of it. I wanted to create a project where they would come to me, so I needed to reach out and find ways to tell people about the project. And like Doug said, I went to a lot of support groups, and I would make a presentation, and I would leave my contact information and would say, there's no pressure. Anybody that, if somebody wants to be a part of this, they can contact me. So I waited for people to find me to photograph them for the project. I wanted them to be able to make the decision on their own without any pressure. And so when Doug called me, it was, he said he wanted to be a part of the project, but could, if I'm remembering correctly, you asked if you could be part of it without a photograph. And I said, you know, we couldn't do that,
but
we can work together to come up with a way to have you in the book without being recognized.
So, Doug, how has it been since then? And many, many years have passed, but I wonder what that was like when people first saw your photo in that collection and what kind of conversations you had.
Really, people didn't see it unless they purchased the book. And if they purchased the book, I wouldn't necessarily know it. So it just was out there. And without any recognizable name or my face, I really didn't have. Now, I would share it with friends and family, but actually nobody knew.
So do you wish that they had, or are you happy that it's more anonymous?
Oh, no. I wish, and I'm glad at the time that it did what it was supposed to do, because I was also pursuing a theater career in Atlanta. So I didn't want to be the face of AIDS in Atlanta or HIV, and that prohibited me from working.
And in many cases, Billy, from some of your stories, it sounds as though the biggest impact was on the people photographed themselves. I wonder if you'd tell me a little bit about Ron, who was the first person you photographed?
Ron was the first person I photographed. I met him at a Grady AIDS clinic. And Grady Hospital AIDS clinic. And it was like the whole project came together just in that one meeting. I was searching for something to do to address the AIDS epidemic, because my dentist, who had become a friend of mine, suddenly vanished. And I later found out that he had contracted AIDS, he had left Atlanta, died at his mother's home in Florida, and had completely isolated himself. And he was a vibrant, very fun man with a lot of friends, and he left them all.
Do you remember what year that was?
1987. It was 1986, because I started the project in 1987. And so I was looking for a way to respond to that. And when I met Ron, that was the entree into that world. And Ron and I bonded immediately. And later he told me the reason that he trusted me was that the first thing I did when I met him was reach out to shake his hand. And that was a period of time when a lot of healthcare workers and people in the police community would not touch somebody with AIDS unless they had latex gloves on. And that just had never, I never bought into that myth. So Ron was, it was similar to my dentist. He had been a healthcare administrator in Clayton County. And when he found out he was HIV positive, he left his job, left all his friends, told nobody where he was going. And when I met him, he was living in a one room, in a rooming house in Atlanta. And what he said in his statement when he wrote the words that he wrote under his picture was that he was afraid of dying all alone. One of the, in the first part of the project, the Atlanta paper, Atlanta Journal-Constitution ran a story on what I was doing, and they ran Ron's picture. His friends and coworkers in Clayton County saw it in the paper and contacted me and said that they didn't, they were worried about Ron, and they didn't know what had happened to him, and he had just kind of dropped off the face of the earth, and could they get in touch with him? So I reached out to Ron and asked him, and he said it was okay, and those coworkers became Ron's support group for the rest of his life.
So he did not.
So he did not die alone, which was his biggest fear. And that...
Because of the photo you took.
It's hard to judge whether you can make an impact with photography, but that one instance, to me, made the entire project worthwhile.
So, Doug, here we are. It's 2016, and Atlanta has a rate of HIV infection that rivals some countries in Africa. And I wonder if you have ideas why. Why, with all the education that we have now, with the improved medication that we have, why are we still struggling with such an incredibly high rate of infection here?
Well, I think part of it may be Atlanta is such a mecca in the southeastern United States for gays and lesbians and people of transgender orientation that they flock there. And they're coming in many cases from a very rural, not as forward-thinking areas of the South. And that may feed part of it, that they're less educated because AIDS now is sort of is looked at, and in many cases is, thanks be to God, a controllable infection. So there's also, I think, that plays a part of it, is that because of the medications, which have made great strides, incredible strides, I'm alive because of it, there's become a sort of laissez-faire attitude. If I get it, I can just start the pills. And now there's even PrEP, which is a prophylactic, where they give you the AIDS medication before you're even infected.
Right.
You're sexually active. So I think all of that's feeding into it.
My guest, you're hearing the voice of Doug Loth. He was one of the dozens of people photographed for this project by Atlanta photographer Billy Howard, who we've been speaking to. He built up a collection of photographs he took 30 years ago of people living with HIV. Each of these photographs comes with a message that the person themselves wrote. That collection is on display now at Emory. Since we're talking about infection rates, though, I want to turn the conversation to some recent research from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Atlanta is the fifth highest metro area for new diagnoses, and I want to bring in now Nicole Roebuck. She's the executive director of AIDS Atlanta, which is Georgia's largest HIV/AIDS service organization. Hi, Nicole.
Hi, good morning.
Let's address this issue of new infections and your opinion on why Atlanta is so high, why we have not been able to bring down the rate of new infections to the level where we would like them to be, which I assume is near zero.
I think there are many several factors that you may see in different publications. I think stigma is still an issue. You heard Billy talk about the huge stigma, and particularly in the African-American community, Billy actually, I liked how he said it, it's like a double stigma on top of the racism, poverty issues that...
And the Hispanic community as well.
And Hispanic community as well. I think even with the Hispanic community, they sometimes become invisible because of some of the laws in terms of immigration, so they've kind of disappeared. So do we really have a real handle on the Hispanic community and the disease in the community? I actually think it's much higher than is reported because of some of those issues with people in the Hispanic community fearing that if they go into a public place, a public clinic, they might be reported and somehow deported out of the country.
You think it may be higher. Now, at this point, the rate of infection is a 1 in 51 chance for all of Georgia. However, black men who have sex with other men had a 1 in 2 risk of being infected. Hispanic men had a 1 in 4 risk. That's compared with a Caucasian man of 1 in 11. You think that that rate of 1 in 4 for Hispanics may be higher than that?
I do. I do because you have to be present to be tested. You know, to be identified, you have to be present and come into a clinic to even be go into care.
To become part of
statistics. Exactly. Yeah. So if I'm afraid, though, that I might be reported to somebody, I might not come in because of some of the immigration laws.
But that causes a problem, and it can increase rates of infection.
Absolutely.
Because they're not being treated. They're not being tested.
That's exactly right. According to some recent statistics from Georgia's epidemiology division, there are about 20,000 people in Georgia who have been identified to be HIV. So they've been tested and they know they're HIV positive, but are not in care. They're not receiving care. And so if they're not receiving care and they're not receiving those life-saving medications that help to lower a viral load and lower the incidence, the additional risk of transmission, then those people are also transmitting the disease.
Is Truvada a solution for people? Truvada is a pill, the only drug that has been proven to prevent HIV infection. I am told that some people see Truvada as the answer. If I'm taking Truvada, I don't have to take any other precautions. Is that correct?
I think it's one tool. We look at prevention in terms of a toolkit. So I think it's one of the tools in the toolkits that works for some people. The other issue, too, with Truvada, you asked about why in the South. There are a lot of poverty issues in the South. There is a lot of access issues in the South, access to health care, health insurance. And so people who may choose to use PrEP, you usually have to have some kind of insurance or the ability to pay for that PrEP and pay for those PrEP medications. For people who are the most at risk, honestly, in terms of disparate health outcomes, they are the people who don't have access to that PrEP because PrEP, you know, isn't free.
PrEP is short for pre-exposure prophylaxis.
Exactly.
Which is supposed to prevent the infection.
Yes.
But this is all then... Let me go back right before in the last 2 minutes that we have. Let me go back to you, Billy, because 30 years on from this project that you started because you wanted to fight the stigma. Is that accurate?
That's accurate.
You're hearing from someone who says people are still being affected because the stigma is still there. What I mean, do you feel as though we've made progress at a good rate?
Well, obviously we've made progress, and Doug is an example of that. I mean, when Doug was when I photographed Doug in 1987, he needed to remain anonymous because health insurance companies and employers would fire people if they found out they were HIV positive. But today, Doug has come out. He's proudly living with a disease that he has been able to manage. He's one of the few people of over 70 that I photographed that survived. He's a survivor and a hero to me. But just his life is a testament that things have changed. But, yeah, I mean, we still have a long ways to go.
Doug, did you want to add to that in the last minute that we have?
I just wanted to say that I've been extremely blessed. The first 10 years of my infection, I didn't have any medication, so my body was able to fight it. And it was the addition of those medications that has kept me alive, and the support of wonderful men like Billy and folks in my life.
That was Doug Lotus. We also heard from AID Atlanta Executive Director Nicole Robach and photographer Billy Howard. Billy's pictures are on display at Emory University and at gpbnews.org. You'll also find information there on where to get free HIV testing. Just ahead, why high-speed internet is slow in getting to rural Georgia. This is On Second Thought.
Hello, hello, baby, you called, I can't hear a thing. I have got no service in the club, you say, say. What, did you say, oh, you're breaking up on me? Sorry, I cannot hear you, I'm kind of busy.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris in for Celeste Headlee. Tomorrow, we will talk about how the Senate's proposal for health care reform could affect Georgians. And we want to know, are you able to access health care when you need it now? Call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457. And you can find us on Twitter or Facebook. And then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. Look, right now, look, up in the sky. It's a bird, and it could well be a bald eagle. America's favorite bird was nearly extinct when it was put on the endangered list in the 1960s. But a record number of Georgia bald eagle nests, more than 200, have been documented this year by the State Department of Natural Resources. We talked about this with Bob Sargent, survey leader with the DNR.
My name is Bob Sargent. I'm program manager and wildlife biologist of Georgia DNR's Wildlife Resources Division. Well, it's good news. If you went back to the 1970s, for most of that decade, there were no successful nests of bald eagles in the entire state of Georgia, which is pretty humbling when you stop and think about that. Here we are, just finished another nesting season in Georgia, which occurs during the winter months, and we recorded a record for Georgia of 218 occupied nest territories in the state. So the species has come a long way. For much of the 20th century, eagles were poisoned, they were trapped, they were shot. The state of Alaska actually offered a bounty on bald eagle legs. If you turned in a pair of legs or the talons, you would get 50 cents in the early days to $2 per pair of legs. Poisoning was a problem. Sometimes it was deliberately targeting bald eagles. Habitat loss was a significant contributor to the decline of bald eagles in the United States. Perhaps 70% of their food base is fish. And so when you have contamination of waterways from pesticide usage, it travels up the food chain. We call it biomagnification. So it gets more and more concentrated. And of course, eagles are at the top of the food chain. The other aspect of habitat alteration or habitat damage that contributed to the decline of eagles was the loss of old growth forests, particularly along waterways, because large old trees are where eagles nest. And by the 1920s in Georgia, most old growth in the state was long gone from logging operations. The efforts of a lot of biologists and private citizens, people with state and federal agencies, nonprofits, who worked together collaboratively, especially starting in the 1970s after the species was listed as endangered. The Southeastern's plan was established in the mid-1980s, and that plan required monitoring. It required research to determine other things that might be depressing eagle populations. The nests and the birds were protected. not only from just outright killing her and harming them, but disturbing them during their nesting activities. So that was significant. Along the way, all the effort, all the sweat, all the labor that was exerted to bring this bird back from no active nests in the early 1970s in the state to 218 this past winter, we've learned many, many things that we can apply to other species that may be more in peril than the bald eagle. Conservation is something that we do every day. This is about responsible use of our natural resources so that they're available for future generations.
That's Bob Sargent with the Department of Natural Resources. You can report eagle nests at 478-994-1438, or you can go online. High-speed internet is not a given in rural Georgia. A recent UGA survey finds that 16% of Georgians are without access to a broadband connection, and most live in rural broadband deserts. And yes, the stakes are higher than getting the latest Netflix series to stream without interruption. Here to talk about these no broadband access areas is Eric McCray. He is the Associate Director of UGA's Carl Vinson Institute of Government. Eric, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Hey, tell me why you took on this project, and had you looked at this issue before?
We had looked at this issue in the past. We had actually been tasked by the Georgia Technology Authority to research and look at broadband in Georgia under the Stimulus Act. And on this, in this particular instance, we had been asked by the Joint High-Speed Broadband Communications Access for All Georgians Study Committee from the Georgia Legislature to actually look at this issue with respect to rural Georgia.
One of the aims, as I recall, and correct me if I'm wrong here, of the Stimulus Act was to expand broadband access specifically to more rural areas. Is that correct?
That is correct. And in fact, they did that through the Stimulus Act. And we did see a large portion of rural Georgia receive broadband at that point in time. But we're still just not there completely.
Okay. So the irony here is that you're conducting this survey and it's a web-based survey. So were the people you most wanted to reach able to respond?
There was some question about that, and unfortunately, the funding that was available to actually do the survey was very limited, and so the most cost-effective methodology was web-based. But we set the survey up so they could do it either via their cell phone, they could do it at work, they could do it at the library. They had the opportunity to report that the information that they were reporting was not at their residence when they were reporting it.
Okay, so let's talk about where you are right now because there's still some work to be done in this study. I'm wondering how many responses you were able to get, and is that about the rate you expected?
We got over 12,000 responses, and we were very happy with that. We had hoped the initial push, we saw just a great response, and we hit about 8,000 in about the first 4 months. Then it kind of slowed down after that. We would have liked to have gotten more responses, mm-hmm. but it is what it is.
Okay, so Eric, did the responses you received, and I guess are still receiving, confirm or contradict some assumptions going into the study?
Well, I think one of the key things is that it confirmed what we believed. There was the maps that were being produced at a federal level, the FCC, the way it was being reported, it was being reported that 97% of Georgians had access to broadband, and we just felt that that was incorrect. Mm-hmm. And this survey helped bear out that evidence and that, you know, 16% of the folks that responded could not get wireline service, and we felt that that was probably indicative across the state.
Yeah, you're talking about maps here. Where are the most sort of broadband deserts found in the state? And I know we're talking about rural areas.
it's going to be in southwest Georgia and basically through central Georgia. There are sections in north Georgia where there are also broadband deserts, but southwest Georgia especially, and basically all the way, all through basically central Georgia.
So the internet, and I didn't think about it this way, is an unregulated utility, and you can explain how that's different from gas or electric. And how does the fact that it is an unregulated utility sort of impact the availability and the quality of the internet service people get?
Sure. So a regulated community would be the Public Service Commission would actually regulate those actual utilities, if you will. And internet is not regulated. And so there is no way that the government can basically come in and enforce rules upon the internet providers to say you will provide X or you will provide Y in this area. And so all of this is basically being done through supply and demand.
Yeah. So we've identified a market here for broadband service that's not being served as well as it could be. And I'm wondering why there isn't a flood of companies running into the area to provide service here.
Sure. The biggest issue is the cost to get the service to the end user. When you start talking about, you know, $16,000 per mile, and then you
make is that the cost of it?
I've had estimates from 16,000 to 30,000 miles per mile to lay the fiber and the backbone to basically get that infrastructure in place. And when you start talking about that, your return on investment is going to be extremely slow. And so the providers are looking at different methods of delivering the service, whether it's wireless or across electrical lines, you name it. They're coming up with new ways to deliver a product.
Yeah, but this ends up being a business story as well, right? So this is President Obama before his 2015 State of the Union address talking about his plan for affordable broadband for all Americans.
Today, high-speed broadband is not a luxury, it's a necessity. This isn't just about making it easier to stream Netflix or scroll through your Facebook newsfeed, although that's fun, and you want, you know, it is frustrating if you're waiting for a long time before the thing finally comes up. This is about helping local businesses grow.
And Eric, is the president correct there? I mean, describe for me how you see this issue of broadband access as a business growth issue in Georgia.
Sure. You have an individual that is sitting at home, basically, that can actually provide service, whether it's a home-based business, working in a consulting role, or any number of ways. And if they don't have access to broadband, they cannot provide those services at home. It's an economic driver. You can't have a business in modern America where you don't have an online presence.
And I'm thinking about students. Look, I've got two young students myself, and I'm thinking they're living on this device. Yeah, for all the YouTube videos and all of that, but also for work that is required for their classes.
Absolutely. And we've actually, part of the survey, we allowed people to provide comments, and we had lots of comments about folks that their daily routine was as soon as their kids got home from school, they loaded up in the car and they drove to the local Chick-fil-A.
Wow.
So they could have access to broadband to do all their homework. And in today's day and age, that's just unacceptable.
So, Eric, what's kind of the fix here as you see it? If broadband service is so important, here's the question. Should the government in some way, shape, or form get involved in this and maybe even in supplying some kind of a subsidy to companies to wire more of the state?
Well, the government's already gotten involved with this through the Connect America Fund, which they continue to do in rolling out basically for wireline carriers through the Telecommunication Act. And so it's a situation where we already have government involvement. The big issue becomes in areas where you don't have telephone providers that are providing this service. How do we get that push to get that to get broadband out there?
And Eric, is access, you know, maybe more slowly than you'd like, is access improving in Georgia?
It is. It's improving. This year alone, we had, I think it was 19 wireless towers go up so that people could have access through wireless versus through a landline connection. And so it's a situation where we see it slowly but surely improving, but for most individuals out there in rural Georgia, it's not improving fast enough.
That's Eric McCray. He is the Associate Director of UGA's Carl Vinson Institute of Government. Eric, thanks.
Thank you.
We also talked to Kyle Wingfield about this issue. He's a conservative columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
As our lives and economy become more digital, urban and suburban Georgians may take high-speed internet for granted. Not so in rural Georgia. Wide swaths of the state might as well be extraterrestrials when it comes to the World Wide Web. There's a line of thought that because broadband is vital 21st century infrastructure for commerce, the government should provide it where the private sector can't or won't. Government has promoted traditional commerce with roads, canals, ports, railroads, and airports. So, this line of thinking goes, it ought to do the same for e-commerce. But rapid technological change makes a big difference. Rolls of fiber optic cable wait to be laid where land is developed. But stringing fiber optic cable over long distances is expensive. It can cost as much as $18,000 per mile, or even $40,000 per mile if it's buried underground. And all this might soon be accomplished wirelessly anyway. This means wiring every residence with miles of fiber may soon become as obsolete as an 8-track player. Here's a tempting comparison from the 20th century, electricity. When FDR launched rural electrification in 1935, just 10% of rural Americans had electricity. And that was more extreme in Georgia. Something like 2/3 of Georgians were in the dark. But the broadband situation is different. An estimated 25% of rural Georgia households don't have access to high-speed internet. The most likely solution here is to get government out of the way. Industry representatives largely agree about what would help. Try cutting taxes on materials and equipment used to deploy broadband, and lowering fees for stringing fiber on poles owned by other utilities. In rural areas, just 4 of every 10 households with access to broadband actually subscribe to the service. A higher uptake rate would make the economics of rural broadband more practical for service providers. And so here's a thought. It just might be worthwhile to subsidize service for lower-income Georgians, rural or urban. Consider two examples. Telemedicine is increasingly sophisticated and conceivably could cut the state's Medicaid costs if enough patients had access to broadband. And since Georgia's public schools are already wired for high-speed internet, online instruction might generate enough savings to subsidize broadband in students' homes. Now, these ideas are far from proven, but they do represent the kind of holistic thinking that could yield a 21st century solution to this 21st century problem.
That was Kyle Wingfield, columnist for the AJC. And that's our show for today, but we always love to hear your comments. Does your internet connection affect your livelihood or your binge watching? You know how to reach us. Call us, leave us a message at 404-500-9457, or you can post to Twitter. We're at OST Talk. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPP News. I'm Tony Harris. Have a great day.